History and Culture Podcasts are a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to PCN's History and Culture Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. This podcast series features interviews exploring Pennsylvania's rich history from the colonial era to industrialization, the Gettysburg Campaign to sports history, and from art to politics and more. Jason Bohm is the author of Washington's Marines, The Origins of the Corps and the American Revolution, 1775 to 1777. Jason, in October 1775, Congress established the Continental Navy. What were the events leading up to this that motivated Congress to create a Navy?
Well, thanks for that question, Phil. So clearly, when the United States, not yet the United States, but the United Colonies went to war with England, England had to move its reinforcements and its resupplies over 3,000 miles across the Atlantic to be able to support their troops located there. And the Americans at the start of the war were lacking many of the essential elements to wage a war, such as cannons. We were not permitted to have our own forges to build our own cannons while we were still a colony to England. So the Americans created a navy for two reasons primarily. One, to block the British from moving resupplies and reinforcements from across the Atlantic. And second, to be able to capture war materials from British ships and to do commerce with other countries to be able to gather the supplies they would need to effectively wage a war. And it was actually an intelligence report that they received on the in early October, which stated that there were two ships laden with war materials heading to Quebec and that these two ships were not protected by any British warships. So Congress tasked George Washington with purchasing two ships initially from the New England colonies to be able to capture these two British ships for the purposes stated. And that actually was the catalyst for the creation of the United States Navy when the Continental Congress first approved the purchase of those two ships, later added two more ships, and then it grew from there.
We usually associate Marines with navies. When the Congress created the Navy in October 1775, did it also make provisions for Marines at that time?
Well, interestingly not. And I thought that was a grave mistake on their part, quite frankly. But so the situation that occurred in April of 1775, people are familiar with Lexington and Concord. And it was the response of the New England militia, which was subsequently assumed to become the Continental Army, putting the British under siege outside of Boston, which precipitated the creation of the Continental Army as a first priority due to that conflict unexpectedly happening on that date. But then, as stated, the Congress quickly realized that America is a maritime nation. It would need forces to operate on the seas as well as on the land. And so hence the creation of the Continental Navy. But it was a little known story that occurred that precipitated the establishment of the Continental Marines. And that is that on the 2nd of November, 1775, the Committee of Safety from Passamaquoddy, Nova Scotia, which was a British hold-in, contacted the Continental Congress asking if they could join the Association of North Americans fighting for their freedoms and liberties. Well, Congress looked at this and they were salivating. They thought this was an opportunity to create a 14th American colony. So the people of Passamaquoddy not only recommended that they join the 13 colonies, but they also recommended to the Congress that they establish a naval campaign to capture the Royal Navy's principal naval operating base, which was located in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And being a naval campaign, that would include not only Navy ships, but also Marines to conduct a land-in in order to capture this key port facility. Now, obviously, at this point, the Americans did not have a Marine Corps. So the Continental Congress created a Navy board that initially consisted of John Adams from Massachusetts, John Langdon from New Hampshire, and Silas Deane from Connecticut. And they met in the second story room of a tavern in downtown Philadelphia called Tun Tavern. And they created a plan to create a two battalions of Marines to be the landing force to conduct this naval campaign to capture Halifax. And interestingly, they thought that George Washington would be the one to lead this naval campaign and lead the two battalions of Marines in the capture of Halifax. So that was the catalyst for creating the first two battalions of Marines. They briefed the Congress on the 9th of November, and on the next day, the 10th of November, the Continental Congress resolved to form two battalions of Marines to be named the 1st and 2nd American Battalion of Marines, hence November 10th, 1775 being the birthday of the Corps.
One of the key early figures was Samuel Nicholas. Who is he?
Samuel Nicholas actually received his commission 3 days after Passamaquoddy contacted the Continental Congress. So on the 5th of November, 75, Continental Congress signed a commission to appoint Samuel Nicholas, who at the time was a proprietor in Philadelphia. He was actually the owner of another tavern called the Conestoga Wagon Tavern. He was a well-known figure in downtown Philadelphia in social circles, and he was identified as the first Marine officer, which also made him the first Marine recruiter because there were no Marines at the time. Now, interestingly, when he received his commission, many people will point to this as Samuel Nicholas being the first commandant of the Marine Corps. In fact, if you go into Pentagon today in the Marine Corps hallway, they have a painting of Samuel Nicholas identifying him as the first commandant. But that's actually not true, because Congress did not bestow the title of commandant onto the Marine Corps until 1798, well after the end of the American Revolution.
Now, you mentioned that Nicholas was a tavern owner. The Tun Tavern plays a significant role in these early days. What was that and what was going on there?
Yeah, so Tun Tavern is commonly known as the birthplace of the Marine Corps. And a lot of people incorrectly point to this as well because they say that Tun Tavern was used as a recruiting station. And actually, the owner of Tun Tavern was a gentleman named Robert Mullen. Robert Mullen was commissioned in the Marine Corps, but not until the following year, 1776, when the British were testing the American defenses on the Delaware River and pushing towards Philadelphia. So it was a full year after the establishment of the Continental Marines that Robert Mullen made Tun Tavern a recruiting station, and they actually did have the fifes and drums out there walking the streets of Philadelphia to draw people into the tavern where, let's be honest, they probably shared a little bit of ale with people before they had them sign on a dotted line. But the real reason that Tun Tavern and the truth about Tun Tavern being the birthplace of the Corps is because of what I stated earlier. It's because the Navy Committee from the Continental Congress, which was later renamed the Marine Committee, met in the second story room of the Tun Tavern when they created the initial plans that were briefed and approved by Congress to create a Corps of Marines.
Once the Marines were created, what was their role on Continental Navy ships?
Well, this is interesting. So again, the original intent for creating two battalions of Marines was to conduct a naval campaign in order to capture Halifax. However, as you know, George Washington was busy holding the British under siege in Boston. And in fact, the way the Continental Congress intended to create these first two battalions of Marines was not to go out and recruit new people. It was to cherry pick soldiers from the Continental Army battalions holding the British under siege outside of Boston who had seafaring experience to be pulled from those battalions, disrupt those chains of command, create these two battalions of Marines, and then have George Washington lead the British at Boston to conduct this naval campaign up north in Halifax. Well, Washington balked at the idea, and a gentleman named John Hancock, which will be a name familiar to most, was the first president of the Continental Congress. George Washington complained to Hancock and said, "Hey, John, there's no way I can do this. You know, I'm busy just trying to clue together the army out of these militia forces from New England, and I'm pretty busy dealing with the British out inside of Boston. Well, John Hancock acquiesced, and he said, okay, George, we understand. And that's when they went to the first Marine officers who were commissioned and told them to go out and start recruiting to form their units of the Marine Corps. Now, originally, Congress approved two battalions that was supposed to be of like size and similar organization to the Continental Army. However, because of the close ties to the Continental Navy, which was now growing in the number of ships as well, they changed the plan so that the Marines wouldn't be organized to fight a land campaign, but would be organized to man ships detachments for each individual ship of the Continental Navy. So instead of two battalions of approximately 388 troops each, they instead decided to create 10 separate companies of 50 Marines each. Each company of 50 would serve on an individual Continental warship. And for the large warships, they would combine two 50-man companies to create a 100-man Marine detachment, in theory. Obviously, the recruiting efforts were difficult during the war. They rarely made it to that level, but generally speaking, that was the model that was used. And there's one other key aspect of this that will play out later in the war. The way the Marines operate is they can do what's called task organize. And when you task organize, if you have a mission that needs to be conducted ashore, you can consolidate several ship detachments to form temporary battalions to operate and conduct limited operations offshore as part of a larger naval campaign. And that would play out here in the second year.
One of the first big operations that the Marines participated in was an amphibious landing in the Bahamas. What was the purpose of that operation and how did it unfold?
Yeah, so this is another great story, and you can't make this stuff up. So by the time that the Congress identified that George Washington could not find any ships up in New England because of a very lucrative privateer industry, he recommended they look further south. So they looked around Philadelphia, and they initially found five merchant ships that were converted into warships. Once they had these first five warships, they needed a commodore to command it, and they found a gentleman named Isaac Hopkins, a 57-year-old former privateer from the French and Indian War from Rhode Island, who was made the first commander-in-chief of the Navy, similar to George Washington being commander-in-chief of the Army. Isaac Hopkins was the only gentleman to hold that title during the American Revolution. He was later relieved of his command, and they never used that title again. But Isaac Hopkins at the time was the first fleet commander, and he received two sets of orders as he took the first fleet to sea in January of 1776. The first set of orders basically described what would the expectations were of the officers and men in performing their duties professionally on the high seas. But the second orders were actually quite ambitious and really unattainable in what they were asking this nascent American fleet of five small converted merchant ships to do. In essence, what he was supposed to do is initially go down to the Chesapeake Bay and seek out, find, and destroy the Royal Navy fleet operating off of the Chesapeake Bay. Once that was done, he was supposed to continue to push further south off of the Carolinas, locate, close with, and destroy the Royal fleet, locate and operating there. And if that were not enough, then he was supposed to shift all the way north to Rhode Island, where he was to seek out, close with, and destroy the Royal Navy fleet operating off of Rhode Island. Now, this is the first deployment of the Continental Fleet. It had never worked together. It had a total of maybe 110 cannons amongst the five ships that were converted from merchantmen. And it was a nascent fleet with no experience. So the thing that Isaac Hopkins did was there was a caveat in his orders that stated, and oh, by the way, if anything unforeseeable occurs or the weather does not permit you to do what we've tasked you to do, use your best judgment in the actions that you take. Well, luckily, for Hopkins, he had earlier received an intelligence report that said that the British were holding loads of gunpowder, cannons, and other ordnance down in the Bahamas in two forts. Fort Mantengao guarded the eastern approaches to Nassau Harbor, and Fort Nassau guarded the western approaches to Fort Nassau. So Hopkins wisely chose to follow his own path and not the direction he received from Congress, and he chose to travel 1,000 miles south to go capture these cannons and gunpowder that he knew were greatly needed by General Washington holding the British under siege. If those of you who know your history will know, the Americans actually only had enough gunpowder to man each soldier with 9 cartridges holding the British under siege. And if the British ever found that out, they could attack. The Americans would run out of ammo immediately, and the war could have ended right there. The other thing is, many people know about the story about Henry Knox taking the cannons from Fort Ticonderoga 300 miles across mountains and frozen lakes in order to place them in to the siege positions to basically force the British to evacuate Boston. Aesop Hopkins had the same plan, but he had a lot further to travel. So he travels 1,000 miles south, and once he gets down there, he assigns Samuel Nicholas, who not only is the first Marine officer, but I said earlier, first recruiter, he also assigned himself to be the commanding officer of the Marine detachment on board Aesop Hopkins' flagship, the Alfred, which was the largest of the 5 ships. And Samuel Nicholas commanded that Marine company beside another little known name gentleman at the time, a lieutenant, first lieutenant of the ship called John Paul Jones, who served side by side with Samuel Nicholas going down to conduct the assault. The fleet made its way south to the Bahamas. Unfortunately, they were identified before they could do a surprise attack. The governor of Bahamas used that opportunity to evacuate much of the gunpowder, but the Americans landed with 234 Marines under the command of Nicholas, reinforced by 50 sailors, and they successfully captured both of those forts. And in doing so, although much of the gunpowder was gone, they captured 88 cannons, 15 mortars, and ships filled of ordnance items. And they then pushed further north to be able to share that captured ordnance with General Washington and several of the colonies to protect their port facilities.
Now let's jump forward to 1776. At some point, Washington's Continental Army has crossed over the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, and Congress orders the Continental Marines to assist and to join the Army in some of its operations. What kind of transition was that for the Marines, and what roles were they playing?
Yeah, great question again. So once the fleet went up north, Aesop Hopkins gave Samuel Nicholas dispatches to carry back to the Congress. He did that, and once he arrived in Philadelphia, because of his success with the raid, the Congress promoted him from captain to major. And then they assigned him to recruit 4 new companies of 50 Marines each to man 4 frigates that were being constructed in Philadelphia. In December of 75, Congress authorized the first 13 American frigates, first American warships to be built from the keel up. And Nicholas had responsibility for recruiting the Marine detachments for the 4 being built in Philadelphia. Washington, as you stated, was defeated in New York and New Jersey. He went south of the Delaware River on the 8th of December, and he started the New York-New Jersey campaign with 19,000 troops. By the time he got south of the Delaware, he was down to only 2,500 that were with him in Pennsylvania at this time. He knew he needed to seize the initiative back from the British, or the war could be lost. So he asked the Congress for additional manpower, and Congress responded by sending some additional militia forces. They sent a group of Philadelphia militiamen known as the Associators, first created by Benjamin Franklin in 1747. And he tasked, the Congress tasked Nicholas with bringing those four detachments off of those four frigates together to form a battalion of Marines. But this time, it wouldn't be to conduct a limited operation ashore as part of a naval campaign, but they would be detached from the Navy and assigned to the Army under General George Washington because of the crisis that was occurring at that moment. So Nicholas took three of the detachments, created this battalion. He left the detachment on board the frigate Randolph in Philadelphia because that ship was close to completion of its construction, and the Congress wanted to put her to sea. So Nicholas took these 120 to 130 Marines, loaded them on gondolas, and took them upriver to Trenton, and that's where Nicholas met General George Washington. Washington didn't know how to respond to the Marines because he knew they would either fight on land or sea. But a gentleman named General John Cadwalader, who was in command of the Associators, showed up at the same time. And because he was a senior officer and from the same area in Philadelphia, Washington went to Cadwalader and said, go talk to those Marines and ask whether they intend to operate on the waters, i.e. the Delaware River, or ashore. And he said, sir, I assure you they're here to work for you and the Army. Washington said, very well, sir, I place them under your command. So the Marines would serve under General Cadwalader and the Philadelphia Associators, but as a separate and distinct battalion as part of the Brigade of Associators.
Now, one of the battles that they would be involved in was at Assunpink Creek on January 2nd, 1777. What happened?
Well, what happened is, as everyone's familiar, Washington successfully attacked Trenton, and he captured approximately 900 Hessian soldiers, which he brought back to the Pennsylvania side as the Marines and Associators went north into New Jersey. Cadwalader wrote to Washington, say, hey, the Hessians are in full retreat. They're all running up towards Princeton. I recommend you come back over and we continue to reap the success that your earlier attack had provided us. Washington does that, and he combines about 6,000 troops now on the south side of Trenton on high ground on the south side of Assunpink Creek. He used the defense of the natural barrier of the creek and the high ground as a natural barrier against the British. General Howe, who was trying to go home to England to see his sick wife, was recalled, sent to Princeton by General Howe, given command of 10,000 troops, and he was ordered to go down to Trenton and wipe out Washington and the Continental forces and end his war once and for all. Washington had sent a small force up north under Edward Hand to conduct a delay in action to give the Americans south of the Assunpink Creek enough time to dig in and prepare their positions. And there was a running battle that occurred all the way into the evening of January 2nd. The Marines and the Associators were initially placed on the right flank to guard the flank of the main position, anchored with Henry Knox's 40 cannons, guarding the bridge going south across the Assunpink Creek from Trenton. The British tried to force that position. Washington identified that that was their principal avenue of attack, so he called the Marines and Associators in to reinforce that principal battle position, and they repulsed two more attacks by the British, ending the day with over 500 British casualties before it became dark and both sides pulled back to their respective sides of the creek.
Now, we only have just a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that we touch on the fact that the Pennsylvania had a Navy and that there were Marines in the Pennsylvania Navy. Give us a brief overview of the Pennsylvania Navy and what role those Marines played.
Sure, absolutely. So at the time, the Pennsylvania Navy consisted of 48 different vessels, all of different size and makes. One of them was a ship called the Montgomery, which was the flagship for the Pennsylvania Navy. And it was actually a former privateer that was now fighting as a Pennsylvania State Marine who took over a Marine detachment on board the Montgomery. So they were ships detachments on board ships. But really interesting is the Pennsylvania Navy built two floating batteries of 12 18-pound cannons each. One was called the Putnam, and the other was called the Arnold. And these were both manned exclusively by Pennsylvania Marines. And one of them was commanded by a gentleman named Thomas Forrest, who would later resign his commission as a Pennsylvania Marine to fight as a Continental soldier in the Continental Artillery. And interestingly, his battery was one of the two in the Battle of Trenton beside a gentleman named Captain Alexander Hamilton, who were firing down King and Queen Street as Washington assaulted Trenton.
We've been speaking with Jason Bohm. He is the author of Washington's Marines, The Origins of the Corps in the American Revolution, 1775 to 1777. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Phil. And thanks so much for what PCN is doing to preserve our great nation's history. I appreciate it. God bless you all and Semper Fidelis.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PCN's history and culture content, like the interview you just heard, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. Explore other documentary programs, event coverage, and a lot more. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.